It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual. For all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs, Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tiger Woods makes it look so easy.
Strokes the putt, sends the putt down towards the cup. Now taking the turn from left to right, and in! And Tiger Woods birdies his final hole.
If only the little white ball could drop that way for Carl Hiaasen, the Miami Herald columnist and best-selling author of Striptease and Nature Girl, returned to the fairways after a 32-year break and a whole lot of living. His adventure became a book and a kind of golfer's confessional, and much more. This hour On Point, we're teeing off on golf and life with humorist Carl Hiaasen. You can join the conversation. Are you breaking out your golf clubs this week for the season? Are you a year-round golfer now, like Carl Hiaasen in Florida or beyond? Is golf the great metaphor for life, or just a great aggravation? Joining me now from New York is best-selling author and humorist Carl Hiaasen. This time he's turned the tables on himself and showing no mercy. His new golf course confessional is The Downhill Lie, a hacker's return to a ruinous sport. Carl Hiaasen, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom. It's good to be here.
Good to have you with us. When were you last on the links, sir?
Sadly, it was yesterday.
How did it go? Are you pulling up out of that sand trap yet?
It was a bloodbath. I'm just going to leave it at that.
You know, I wish you'd read just from right from the very top of The Downhill Lie, or just about there, Dawn of the Dead, you call it. You've got a little bit that takes us back to when you quit and maybe what brought you back. And some of the harrowing stuff that you found when you came back.
Harrowing is the word for it.
Read us a little bit, Carl.
All right. On the day I gave up golfing, I stood 6 feet even, weighed a stringy 145 pounds, and was in relatively sound physical shape. When I returned to the game, I was half an inch taller, 21 pounds heavier, and nagged by the following age-related ailments: elevated cholesterol, a bone spur deep in the right rotator cuff, an aching right hip, a permanently weakened right knee due to a badly torn medial meniscus that was scraped and repaired in February 2003 by the same orthopedic surgeon who'd once worked on a young professional quarterback named Dan Marino. The doctor had assured me that my injury was no worse than Marino's. Then he'd added with a hearty chuckle, "But you're also not 22 years old." Other factors besides my knee joint HDL had changed during my long absence. When I'd abandoned golf in 1973, I'd been a happily married father of a 2-year-old son. When I returned to the sport in 2005, I was a happily remarried father of a 5-year-old son, a 14-year-old stepson, and a 34-year-old son with 3 kids of his own. In other words, I was a grandpa. Over those three busy and productive decades, a normal, well-centered person would have mellowed in the loving glow of the family hearth. Not me. I was just as restless, consumed, unreflective, fatalistic, and emotionally unequipped to play golf in my 50s as I was in my teens. What possesses a man to return in midlife to a game at which he'd never excelled in his prime, and which in fact had dealt him mostly failure, angst, and exasperation? Here's why I did it. I'm one sick bastard.
Carl Hiaasen reading from his new book, The Downhill Lie. I don't know if you're sick, but are you crazy? I mean, restless, consumed, unreflective, fatalistic, emotionally unequipped. That doesn't sound like the kind of prescriptions they lay out for golf zen glory.
No, none of the golf zen books that you get will ever come up with that personality for me. And I think part of it's a function of I think writers in general are probably not well equipped for the golf course. I know that there are some great writers who golf. John Updike golfs, and I believe Cormac McCarthy golfs. But I think for the most part, the golf course is far too serene and reflective place for, you know, AAA personalities. And I just, you know, I don't fit. I didn't fit when I was young. And it turns out I haven't really mellowed a hell of a lot either.
So what were you doing back then? The last time you and I talked, I recall you told me, I mean, you were a fisherman. You were a bonefish. And that,
right.
Have you given up fishing to golf? Why?
No, I'll tell you why. I was and still am a saltwater fly fisherman, which has another degree of fanaticism and you know, all kinds of disorders that go with that as well. But my family, we lived in the Keys, Florida Keys, for a number of years. And then we moved up a little farther north in the state to a place called Vero Beach. And the kind of fishing that I like to do in the Keys isn't really available to me there in the same way that I did it. And so I had to find another unhealthy obsession, which is, I think, necessary for every writer. You know, you spend a day locked in your office pounding away, and you need at the end of that day to be able to go out and clear your brain. Mm. And golf is a game that requires you not to think about anything else. It's very hard to be preoccupied or in any way distracted out there, because it's hard enough when you're totally focused. It's impossible if you're not focused at all. So I think I saw it as some sort of challenge, some way to get my mind off the work and what I'd been working on. I don't know. You know, I think I was probably a little bit optimistic, but at the time I thought, well, this is just what I need.
And of all things, talking about distraction, it was a job writing about the photographic shoot of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition that got you refocused
yes.
on golf. I'm not sure how that works. Tell us.
Well, this is another sign of drifting into middle age, I think. I had... several years ago, Sports Illustrated had asked me to go down to Barbados, and they wanted me to write a funny piece of fiction for their swimsuit edition. But they wanted me to go down and sort of see what the shoot was like. In other words, just stand on the beach and watch these beautiful half-naked women be photographed. Yeah, it was a terrible assignment. And I was brilliant enough to insist that my wife come along, because otherwise I probably wouldn't have gotten out of the house alive.
And she said she's Greek good with cutlery, you say.
Yes, she's deft with cutlery. Right. And so we took our little guy with us, and we went down there to this resort called Sandy Lane, which later Tiger Woods would actually get married there, ironically enough. And there was a great editor at Sports Illustrated then, Bob Rowe. He was the only one in the entourage that showed up with golf clubs. And I thought, here we are in this setting and all these models, and Bob's bringing his golf clubs. Well, he'd been on a lot of these photo shoots, and I learned quickly what he had learned is that, and as hard as it is to believe, they do get boring after a while, because there's a lot of sitting around. There's a lot of thong adjusting going on. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of choreography to these things. And my attention span is not what it was when I was 17 or 18 for that sort of thing. It's like sitting on a movie set, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, you think, going to a movie set is going to be thrilling, and it is for about 10 minutes, and then it's a drag. It just wasn't a drag, but after a couple of days, I'd gotten enough material I needed for the piece I was writing, and Bob finally, he said, come on, you got to come play. He'd heard, we'd been talking, and he said, you used to play when you were a kid. Why don't you come out and play golf with me tomorrow? And I said, I'm not going anywhere. He said, they got monkeys on the course. And I said, monkeys? And, you know, I'm a sucker for a good game of monkey golf. Who isn't? And they had wild monkeys on this golf course. So I went out and played 18 with Bob. We saw one dramatically large monkey. And that sort of got me thinking about golf again.
And what was it? Was it an acknowledgement that you were 50-something now? And was this your pre-retirement, you know, lay back into the golf cart step or something else?
No, I mean, I never, even when I was young, I never found golf to be the least bit relaxing. And I think it always involves, I think a round of golf is always a journey into the darkest recesses of the human soul, for me anyway. But I think that's where writers are drawn. I mean, I knew there was going to be
pain.
Heart
of darkness on the links?
Right. I knew there was going to be pain. I knew there was going to be misery and self-abasement. All those things sort of come with the territory. But you, in the, you know, deep in your middle-aged soul, you think you can conquer it, because there are plenty of guys my age playing fantastic golf. They're just, you know, they're terrific golfers. Now, they didn't stop for 32 years like I did, which is a little bit of a hurdle to overcome. But I thought, well, maybe I can overcome it. You know, I think one of the big attractions of golf is the self-delusion, is the idea, because you can stand up there on any given day and hit a pretty good shot. And then you delude yourself into thinking it can happen again and again and again. And, of course, that's folly.
You know, I'm not a golfer. I grew up working a lot on a farm. And to me, golf was too much like swinging a hoe, you know, walking around in the sun and swinging a long
stick. It is the way I play it. It's exactly like that.
But I know people, despite all this Heart of Darkness cruelty of the game and all the rest that you describe here and in the book, people are absolutely addicted to it. If it's such a cruel punishment, what's the addiction?
You hit it on the head. There is an addictive quality to it, and I wish I could say that I solved that mystery as well, and I didn't. All I know is that like yesterday was, as I said, a bloodbath, and if I had any brains at all, I would throw my golf clubs off a bridge at this point. But I know what's going to happen is a week or so will go by, or I'll get done with the book tour and someone will talk me into going out and playing up. And I may play like 9 holes halfway competently, and then I'll think I've got the whole game solved again. And that's the rhythm of the emotions that go with the game. And also, to be honest with you, if you work in an office, or, you know, like a writer does, you work sort of in a solitary, closed up place, there is an attractive aspect to just going out and walking in the sunlight in a beautiful sort of green oasis of trees and lakes and things, and just, you know, sort of breaking free of the office pall and just stumbling around even for 18 holes, but just being outdoors. There's something, especially, you know, in Florida, of course, where we have nice weather 11 and a half months out of the year. It's pretty, you know, there is an appeal to that. Just, I'm just going to go out for a long walk and try not to let the golf ruin it.
Give me the strength. Hit the ball easy. That's all I want to do, Lord. Give me the strength to follow through.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about golf and life with Carl Hiaasen and his little less than triumphant return to the game after 32 years away. It's quite a different experience for Anthony Kim. On Sunday, the 22-year-old won the Wachovia Championship in North Carolina, the young man's first victory on the PGA Tour.
I'm a little bit numb right now, but that walk-up 18 was the best feeling of my entire life, and I'll never forget that feeling. And I had chills going up and down my spine, and I want to recreate that as many times as possible now, so I'm going to really work hard.
Anthony Kim with his first big PGA title, and he feels the good chills. Carl Hiaasen describes good and bad chills both in his new book, The Downhill Lie, A Hacker's Return to a Ruinous Game. He joins us from New York. You can join the conversation. What's your question for Carl Hiaasen on golf and aging and life? Have you golfed in Florida? What do you see playing out on the links there, on the links in your hometown? And what's your question for Mr. Florida on golf, subprime real estate, politics, primaries, you name it, growing old with alligators? Let's go straight to Wagner, South Carolina, and Chuck. Carl Hiaasen, he's calling in to talk with you. Chuck, you're on the air with Carl.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, my parents retired to Florida to a place near Winter Haven to a small community that had a golf course, and they never golfed till they went there. Well, they got there and started golfing, and yes, it is very addictive. That's all they talked about. They watched it on TV. And the seniors got, you could only play 3 times a week, so the seniors got just vicious with each other. They thought somebody was sneaking in an extra round or so of golf, and it got almost splitting the community up. It was I thought they were going to have a coup out there or something.
Has it been good for them, Chuck, or has it driven them nuts?
Well, I'll tell you what it did was it gave me enough respect that I don't ever want to try the game. So you can take it from there. I guess they did become, say, in their 80s, early 80s, totally fanatical.
And were they any good, or did it matter?
Not really that good there. I guess what you call duffers or something, you know.
Yeah. Chuck, thanks very much. Carl, what do you say to Chuck? His parents have found a pretty good sideline there in golf in their golden
year. It is interesting in Florida, even when I was a kid, too. I mean, in the retirement communities, it became pretty much of a blood sport. The folks took it very, very seriously. And there's a whole community in Florida around Ocala where there's probably 100,000 golfers all clustered together. It's a housing development, and you arrive, and one of the first things that happens to you, first of all, you have to be 55 to even be allowed in. Which I could go move there right now, and my wife probably wishes I would.
You're just over the wire, yeah.
But the first thing they do is, because they had so many accidents, they have to give everybody driving lessons in golf carts. And you actually
we're not
have
talking
to go,
about driving the ball down the fairway, just playing
no,
driving,
just riding, driving the golf cart, because I guess it would become hazardous. There were so many golf carts going every different direction. You can imagine 100,000 golfers running amok. So there is an element of fanaticism, and I mean, people who get caught up in it get caught up in it in a serious way. I mean, I guess it's. You know, I haven't had that experience yet, but I've seen people possessed in that way.
But you describe, as a 50-something returning to golfing, how your attitude toward the seniors on the course was a little different from when you were a younger guy, a little more sympathy.
I do have a little more sympathy for them. I mean, when I was a kid and we played, of course, and playing in, growing up in South Florida, there was an age. There were clashes in the different age groups on the golf course. We played fairly briskly and raucously, if I could put it like that, with my friends.
As a young man, yeah.
As a young fella. And then sometimes the folks in front of us weren't moving along quite the way we thought they should. And we would encourage them in various ways, just kind of hitting it a little bit close just to get the move and get them, wake them up a little in the morning. And
a different kind of monkeys on the golf course.
Yeah, we were absolutely incorrigible. And then now, of course, you understand that these things take time, and there's a deliberative process before every shot, and you move a little bit slower and a little more respect for the group in front of you as well. So it was one of the etiquette lessons that you learned during the 32-year layoff, especially when your knee goes bad on you.
Right. You quote Tiger Woods, of course, saying there is no comfort zone in golf, but maybe you can provide a little comfort with that tolerance there. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. And Mark, you're on the air with Carl Hassan.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Carl.
Hey.
I just wanted to say first, I've read all of Carl's books. I thoroughly enjoy him as an author. I first played golf in my teens, and a couple of years ago, I was invited to participate in a golf scramble for with some guys in my church.
Now, what is a golf scramble, Mark?
Well, it's basically you get out there and just start playing, and at the end of the day, somebody wins door prizes. But it was for charity, and you paid a certain fee to get in and that sort of thing. But I hadn't played in 30 years, basically, and so I got my first birdie.
Hey,
we were playing, and we had to hit it over a pond, and I hit it over the pond, and it went a line drive right into a duck.
And that was your birdie.
And that was my birdie.
Oh, wait a minute.
That's
a ducky.
I sympathize with Carl's stories about monkeys and all of that.
You brought down some wildlife. Oh, good heavens. Mark, thanks for your call. You know, that reminds me, Carl, of your extended kind of meditation in the book, The Downhill Lie, on how your dad brought you to golf, but it wasn't exactly the idyllic father-son out on the course thing that we might imagine there.
Well, or that both of us had hoped for. When I first started to play, I mean, my dad was a very, very good golfer, and he would practice in the front yard with his pitching wedge, and chipping. And I would go out with my baseball glove and just catch the wedge shots. And finally, I talked him into taking me on Sundays. And I had two missions. One was to obviously to spend more time with my dad, who was somewhat of a workaholic. And the second mission was to weasel out of going to church with my family, my mom and my brothers and sisters. And so I thought, how hard can golf possibly be? I mean, I'll just learn to play, and then Dad does it. I go with Dad to the course on Sunday. That's how it started. And then his temperament was much different than mine. He was very patient, very deliberative, and very thoughtful about the game. And I was just a kid, and I was hot headed, and I was I thought I should be able to go out and play as well, or at least keep up with him on the course. Mm. And when you're not, you're a little kid and you're falling behind, you're scuffing the ball all over the place. I got frustrated. I'd throw my clubs. I cussed. you know, worse than he cussed, and it wasn't, and I, you know, it wasn't the greatest for him. It must have been tough. For me, it was just seething anger. But for him, I mean, it was time that I still wanted to spend every minute with him that I could. I just wish I'd behaved a hell of a lot better than I did.
You write that your father died suddenly in February 1976. My father died suddenly at the outrageously unfair age of 50. Did that then have anything to do with your relationship with golf?
Sure it did. I had quit in college in 73, and I hadn't played much, but I followed the game as a fan. Once you've played, you can never stop watching on TV because you realize how difficult it is. And Dad and I would always talk about, you know, that was a bond we had, we talked about. And I'd always kind of held out hope that I might go back and play again with him someday. Once I was out of college and sort of had a job and was sort of on track with my life, and he passed away. And once that happened, I got to say that it sort of extinguished any interest or any lingering whim that I might have had to go do that again. I mean, it really was sort of the end of it for me. And put the club, you know, the clubs were already in the closet. I had no thought of taking them out again. Didn't even think about it after that. And I guess that was probably the wrong reaction and not one he would have wanted me to have. But it did. You know, there were a lot of memories associated with the game that become sad at that point for me. So that was another reason it's prolonged my absence.
Scuffing along that course with Dad, and suddenly Dad wasn't there. Let's get a call from Dan in Kiowa, South Carolina. Hi, Dan. You're on the air with Carl.
Hi, Carl. I guess my question is similar to the last caller's. I'm just finishing a golf vacation with my three brothers and my father. And we live on opposite coasts. We don't get to see each other very much. And his gift for the game was not apparently genetically transmitted to his sons. I was wondering, first of all, how you learned to play, and also, you know, is your dad a much better golfer?
Well, yeah, I mean, go ahead.
Well, Dan, I just wanted to ask you before, we'll get that from Carl Hyacin, but first, how is it when you play with your three brothers and your fathers? Is that civil war or peaceable kingdom on the golf course?
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, he's tried to teach us in his way, and now emotions have mellowed over the years. There used to be a lot of torment and a lot of thrashing around, throwing the clubs, and but I think now we're happy to see each other. But still, you know, you see shades of that old interaction, you know, the old habits on the course, the old strokes coming back, and my dad really just wants us all to enjoy it and play better. And that's what his goal is, but I think sometimes you don't always see it that way.
Lucky you to be out there with your dad that way. Carl, how about it? How you actually learned? Was it your father who did the most teaching or
he was wise enough, Tom. No, he wasn't a teacher by nature. And he also, it's difficult when you're learning from a relative. And so he got me lessons at a very young age at the golf course. And not very. I think I must have been 10 or 11 or something, pretty young. Mm-hmm. And we would have a lesson, and then I would leave the range and go find him on the course, or he'd pick me up and we'd play a few holes together. And he would help me out while I was swinging on the course. But mostly what I wanted to learn from him was just, you know, he had this smooth swing, he had this great attitude, and these are things that I badly wanted to absorb, and obviously my DNA did not contain any of that stuff to this day. I wish it had, but you know what the caller mentioned, which was interesting, and you find that years can pass, and you get out there, and the game of golf really is, and writers really don't need to be any more introspective than they are because they're almost pathologically introspective.
Enough already,
Yeah, but golf is one game that it really holds a mirror up to your character and your personality. The worst of your worst character traits come out and the best character traits come out. There's no escaping it. I mean, you can't blame whatever happens, you can't blame it on anybody but yourself. So it sort of strips bare all the pretensions and everything else. Mm-hmm. A bad day of golf, how you behave on a bad day of golf probably says more about your character than anything else.
You quote Jack Nicklaus saying, if there's one thing golf demands above all else, it's honesty. There's a wonderful passage about you and your father on the course and that difficult interaction. I wish you'd read for us a bit of that, if you would, Carl.
Sure. As frustrating as those outings often were, I don't regret a moment spent golfing with him. I do regret my conduct, swearing and fuming and blowing up over bad shots. Had I known that Dad would be gone from our lives so soon, I wouldn't have spoiled those days by acting like such a jerk. Although he wanted me to love the game as much as he did, we weren't wired the same way. I was impatient, hot-headed, and self-critical, the worst possible disposition for a golfer. Usually I'd pick up my ball before the round was done, and Dad would let me drive the cart the rest of the way. At that point, all the pressure was off. And I have wonderful memories of sitting at the wheel, watching my father swing a driver with a sweet, fluid rhythm at which I could only marvel. Looking back on those weekends, I can't help but feel sorry for my mother, locked out of such an important part of her husband's world. She was a golf widow long before it became a cliché. Considering the arguments that took place in our house on Sunday mornings, Mom would seem an unlikely fan of the game. Yet she is. When I broke the news that I'd started playing golf again, she said it was a great idea. During my next visit, she gave me some black and white photographs of Dad that were taken by one of his aunts in the summer of 1942 when he was 16. In the pictures, he's tanned and lean, his hair blonde from the sun. One snapshot shows him blasting out of a bunker, and another he's pitching to a green. There's also a backlit photo of him holding the pose after hitting a fairway iron, and hands high, hips fully rotated, belt buckle square to the target. My father had one of the loveliest golf swings I've ever seen. Mom says the same thing. Although I'll never be able to play as well as he did, the photographs are a sentimental inspiration. They're tacked to the corkboard in my office.
Carl Hiaasen, reading from his new, golf course confessional, The Downhill Lie, A Hacker's Return to a Ruinous Game. And it is a beautiful thing to remember that relationship. It can be beautiful right out there on the course. We've got a lot of listeners who want to speak with you. Let's go to Molly in Nashville, Tennessee. Molly, you're on the air with Carl Hiaasen.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Carl. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Carl, you are one of my all-time favorite authors. My dad is a native Florida boy. He's from Gainesville, and he used to read me your books when I was a kid.
That's nervy.
I'm sorry?
That's a little nervy, given Carl's, let's say, wicked humor, but great.
Well, he edited quite a bit. My mom wasn't upset. But one of the things I think that he loved most about your work, and which seems like a continuing theme, is your anger over the continual sort of rape of the natural world in Florida. And it seems like golf courses are a number one perpetrator of that sort of thing. I was wondering how you reconcile the two.
It's a great question, Molly.
It's a great question, and it's something I struggled with. Because you're right, in some places in particular, golf courses in Florida have become basically an excuse for massive housing development. So I was determined that I was not going to play at one of those courses or belong to a club like that because the course itself is relatively small in acreage. But when they build these massive, massive developments around and sell it as golf course property, it's, you know, doom for all the wildlife and destroys the habitat all around the course itself. So I did the best I could. I chose a course near where I live in Vero Beach. It was basically built on a dead orange grove. There was not much there, but thousands of dead trees before they turned it into a golf course. And the developers of this particular property were committed to having no housing around it. You know, no condos, no even single family homes, nothing. Just sort of keeping it as a golf course in the middle of nowhere.
But given what a champion you've been of the sort of wild world, I can imagine Molly thinking, "Yeah, but what about the chemicals and the herbicides and all the rest that go into the golf?"
Well, a lot of the courses, including the one I belong to, have now gone very green with that stuff. And they've been brought to task over the years. The whole industry, the whole golfing industry now, from my reading of it, while I was researching this book, is that it's a very uncool thing to be dumping pesticides and herbicides into the turf these days. So they go to great pains to use recycled water and a lot of other things. Obviously there's an impact on it. But here's my position, especially with regards to the development in relation to Florida in particular. I can promise you that if this wasn't a golf course, there'd be about 1,000 single-family homes on this property. The impact of that is many, many, many times worse than a golf course is.
So worse things could happen.
In Florida, they always do. Always.
Molly, thanks for your call from Nashville. Carl Hiaasen is with us. His new book is The Downhill Lie. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. You tee off on the final hole, a perfect drive again. But your iron takes a funny hop and splash, what happens then?
Oh, the bad shots. The bad shots gonna get you. They always will. They always will, I bet you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Florida humorist, columnist, novelist Carl Hiaasen about life and golf and his new, what, memoir, confessional, you name it, The Downhill Lie, it's called. A hacker's return to a ruinous game. He spent 32 years away and came back to golf. You can join the conversation. Have you got your clubs out yet this season? And what are you talking about, dreaming of, chasing on the golf course? And we've got John on the line from Manning, South Carolina, with the question all America is asking. John, let's hear it.
My question would be, plain and simple, Carl, what is your handicap?
There we go.
I knew you couldn't. Somebody paid you to. As of today, now, my USGA handicap index, which you're familiar with, it means the index that's applied to figure out what you would be at any given course, is 13.3 strokes. But after yesterday, what I did yesterday on the course here in New Jersey, there's no – I don't even think they've got it calculated that high. Even the USGA hasn't figured out. I'm sure it's skyrocketing. But right now, my handicap index is 13.3.
You say – oh, it's 13.3. But that's not bad, is it?
It's horribly deceptive. And not only that, I can assure you that if anyone who tried to figure this out mathematically, statistically, what the handicap index meant or how they got to it – would go nuts. You would need to be completely sedated by the time you got done with all the mathematics on that.
But I'm not a golfer by any means. But if the golfers out there, when they hear 13.3, are they saying, "Well, he's not so bad"?
They might be saying that, but the real golfers will know that on any given day, I can shoot 105 or I could shoot an 85. I have a dear friend of mine, Tom. This is a true story. Who I went to high school with, and who's played consistently all the years I wasn't playing. He continued to play. So he goes out the other day. And he shoots a 76, which is the second best score of his life. That's four over par on a very tough course. It's a great day of golf.
Yeah.
The next day he goes out, same guy, same set of clubs, shoots a 107. Mm-hmm. Now, you have two choices, either to hang yourself at that point or just say that's just golf. That's the way golf is.
Let me just read a little thing that you've got here, and then I've got a question. You say, yet every weekend, thousands of otherwise rational men and women are cursing, kicking at divots, and smashing expensive milled putters against the trunks of immovable hardwood trees. These players go home in a toxic funk to inflict gloom upon their loved ones until the following Saturday, when they rush back to the golf course and do it all over again.
Yep.
Why the toxic funk? I mean, why do people get so upset when their golf game is bad? Everybody's got a bad game of something once in a while.
You're right, but let me just tell you that not being a golfer, you can't appreciate. There's nothing more horrifying than a bad, really bad golf shot. It's more damaging to the psyche, to the soul, or to the wrist bones of your hand, for that matter. Yesterday, I had a shot where I was sitting squarely on a root of an oak tree, and it was a wonderful lie if you happen to be a squirrel or a beaver, but if you're a human being trying to hit the ball, it wasn't. And, you know, the impact of the metal blade of the club head on the root is still I can still feel it in my rotator.
And the oak tree, too, maybe.
The oak tree was fine. I assure you, the oak tree was just – I wasn't the first person that had been on that root. I have a feeling.
Let's go to Doug in Marlboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Doug. You're on the air with Carl Hiaasen.
Oh, hi, Tom. Hi, Carl.
Hi.
I've enjoyed many of your novels, particularly Stormy Weather.
Thanks.
You're welcome. I came to golf a little late in my 30s. First time I golfed was with my uncle, who taught me a lot of things about respect for the game and when to shut up and when to talk. He was probably a single-digit handicap with old tour blade clubs in his day, so he was quite the guy. He also told me that golf is flog spelled backwards.
I've heard that.
But I think the reason why it's so addictive is because on any given day, if you have any kind of athletic ability, you can do what a professional can do, albeit maybe once or twice in a round.
Right.
I think that's what gets people to, you know, I've made a 70-foot putt. I've made a hole in one. I've put an 8-iron in from 150 yards for an eagle on a par 4. And I think that really, that's what gets you coming back. I couldn't go out and hit pitches against Josh Beckett. I couldn't go play one-on-one with Paul Pierce or even a good college basketball player. So,
but a brush with genius, with magic on the golf course, maybe.
Yeah, but it's fleeting.
It's very fleeting.
But you have to go right on the golf swing to make that ball go where it's supposed to go. You know, it's amazing. Sometimes you get two things that go wrong and they cancel each other out and you hit a great shot. So yeah, it's very frustrating.
But it's true, though. The instruments that you use when you go out on the golf course are not really that much different than what Tiger is hitting or Phil is hitting. And when you go to a tournament and you see these guys, or you go to a women's tournament and you see them, you think, you know, they're not that much. I mean, Tiger being the exception, yeah, but they're not that much bigger and stronger.
Oh, right.
I mean, they're not. It's not like looking at a linebacker, an NFL linebacker. Some of the men player, Charles Howell III is skinny, and he hits the driver about 330. And you think, well, I can, you know, physically, there's no reason in the laws of physics that I couldn't duplicate what he just did. And once in a great while, maybe once around, maybe twice around, you hit a shot that a pro could have hit. And you're absolutely right. That's what brings you back. It's that one good shot that keeps sucking you back into the Dante's circle of hell. That's it.
Doug, you're giving us a little insight into the ethereal magnetism there. Thank you for that. Let's get a call from Wayland, Massachusetts. And Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
First, Mr. Hyacinth, I wanted to suggest that your books become required reading for anyone considering moving to the state of Florida. Yeah, well, I don't think the state would agree with that, would they?
Boomer tsunami.
Right. I've been told I'm an unusual guy in that I'm a non-golfer or maybe a future golfer, and I enjoy watching it on television.
And, oh, you're weird.
Well, that's what they say, and I think, well, it's just like any sporting event to me.
Does it help you fall asleep on Sunday afternoons, or what's the deal?
Actually, no. I think it has happened a few times.
Okay.
But it's the whole competitiveness of it. It's the it's the drama. It's I think it's the atmosphere too.
You like the way they talk, that he's lining up now, he's got his putter, whatever it is that they're saying. I don't know, but
right. What? Right, but I just wonder if anyone else out there is the same way. I plan on taking it up when my kids have grown and left the house. And
you don't want them to see it. I don't blame you. It'll be ugly. You don't want them to be around.
Well, I got enough distractions right now. I don't need another one. And
I've
heard is that that's one of the biggest distractions is taking off for the whole day of Sunday. So I'm trying to avoid that for the time being.
Well, Carl, what do you say about the man who doesn't play but likes it on TV? Did you watch it in all those years away? And give him some tips on if he picks it up now, when the kids go, you know, if he follows in your footsteps, oh wise one, what are your tips on that?
Well, I mean, with all those years I didn't play, those three decades, I still watched it as a fan because having played when I was young, I knew how incredibly difficult it was to play. And to me, it wasn't boring at all to watch until it was remarkable to see what these guys could do on a Sunday with those same set of clubs that I had as a kid. If you take it up again, I mean, my first advice would be my first reaction would be the same as David Faraday's reaction when I told him, was, are you out of your mind? I mean, I've cleaned that up a little bit for this show, but because he said the same. I said the same thing. I said it's like it gets in your blood, and he said, absolutely. That's why I'm warning you against it, because it does get in your blood.
Hear me now.
Even now. And it is the addictive quality that they're warning you against, because it can lead you down a dark and bloody road if you're not careful.
let's get another right here from Michael in Ashford, Connecticut. Steve, thanks for the call. Michael, you're on with Carl Hyacinth.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm another non-golfer, but I do enjoy watching Tiger Woods on television. He's just an interesting person to watch. But my question for Mr. Heisman would be that there's got to be some sort of psychological payoff to golf over the long term. You know, it can't all be, you know, negative and frustration. For me, with tennis, it's a good read on how my body is doing, how my mind is doing, especially as I get older. I'm aware of my reflexes, my vision, how my knees are. But I wonder if there's a different psychological benefit going on with golf.
Carl?
Well, I think it's similar in a sense, but also you have to – I mean, someone can play competitive golf and play golf fairly well, easily into their 70s. And I played some tennis too, and I still play some. And I know that there is a limit to you know, your mobility at some point on a tennis court. As you get older, you certainly feel yourself slowing down. Anybody who can hit a golf ball straight and consistently and can putt can score well and be very, very competitive and play with someone 30 years younger than they are and kick their butts. On a tennis court, a guy who's 75 is going to have trouble against a 40-year-old no matter what, usually. So, I mean, there is a physical difference, but I think with the payoff, as I said before, in golf at least, is that one good shot that you hit, usually on the 17th or 18th hole after a dreadful round, you hit one that Tiger could have hit, or you think he could have hit. And there it is, you're 6 feet from the flag, and you sink it for a birdie. And then on that moment, in that golden shining moment, it's the greatest game in the world. And you're on top of the world. And that's what brings you back, is you're remembering that shot and not the 107 other shots that weren't so good during that day.
But the 107 take up most of a golfer's time if you're not Tiger Woods. And what about the psychological payoff in that period? I mean, you've got this great line. You say, I believe this is how you're supposed to feel with a golf club in your hands, full of heart and free of mind. But you go on to write about how, in fact, you feel constricted of heart and tangled of mind. I mean, does it end up impugning your psychological health as much as it may bolster it in those golden moments?
I think if you're at least my age, you try to learn from the sport. You try to learn to modulate, you know, or moderate, I guess, your emotions in a way that when you see a kid pick up a golf club, you see an 8 or 9 year old, 10 year old kid on the golf course. Most of them are having a blast, no matter what they're doing, no matter how well or poorly they're playing. Just having a blast. It's a great day in the sunshine. And I think as you get older, your goal should be get back to that frame of mind that it's a great day in the sunshine. You know, yesterday I played with a guy who had 2 spinal operations and he had to wear a back brace and he was still pounding the ball. He played great. And he said, but you know the difference between now and before I had my surgeries? He said, now I appreciate every step that I take out here. And that's a great lesson. He's just happy to be there. Even if he was shooting 100, he would have been happy to be there.
That's great. Let's take a call from Betsy in Wayland, Massachusetts. Betsy, you're on the air.
Hi, nice to talk to both of you. A little bit, somewhat similar perspective as many others, but I am a golfer, or try to be. I was taught to play golf by my dad when I was about 15, and he takes me out on the course, and he was a great golfer, sounds very much like your guest's dad, too. And I parred the first hole and thought, well, piece of cake, this is a game that is obviously mine, and as he has been saying, that was a short-lived triumph, and it very rarely happens anymore. But my husband is an avid golfer, and we live here in the Northeast, but yet he somehow manages to try and play all through the winter to the point that he has built 4 little golf holes in our backyard.
Oh, boy.
He's been out in practice as much as he can. But the best was last summer. He had a mom who was 97 and exceedingly healthy, which is lovely, and my mom, who was 87, we took them both out to play golf with us. And my mom was able to hit a few shots because she's played before, and his mom learned to putt for the first time in her life at age 97 and loved every second.
Get out of town. You're going to have John McCain's mom out there with you pretty soon, too.
I know, and I'd take her in a second. I just want to say the game is truly for everyone, but you do need to make sure if you're doing it with people that have never played again, that you don't have people behind you waiting, because that is not fair.
87 and 97, that's a very great day in the sun, Betsy. Our time's winding down, but I love the story. And let me get one or two more here if I can. Wally in Lowell, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, I think it's I'm Larry.
Oh, Larry, yeah.
Hi. I will keep it quick. I'm not a golfer either. I'm an archer. The same zen applies to archery as does to golf. You have unlimited perfect equipment, you know, and one person against it. And, you know, I slammed the bow against the wall as quickly as someone else would do a golf club. But I saw a poster one time that I think you guys might find amusing. And it is a quote from King James II, who wrote the Bible for us in English, so he must be right. And the quote was, a proclamation, the playing of golf is utterly forbidden, as it interferes with the practice of archery, so necessary for the defense of the realm.
So So bring out the archers and clear the field. It sounds like you might be grabbing a weapon now and then, Carl. But
well, the thought of myself with a bow and an arrow in my hand is even more frightening than with the three wood.
Yeah, that's great. Larry, thanks very much for that. And you write interestingly about what it means to be a writer on the golf course. Because
yes.
After all, as a writer, well, you in some funny way, you celebrate all the kinks in your one's mind. Your mind maybe in particular, Carl. I've read your stuff. But golfer's supposed to have that clear mind.
No, I've never been accused of having a clear mind or even a normal thinking mind. But you're right. And for a writer who is, whether you're a journalist or a novelist or both, like myself, it's just a different world entirely to go from the world inside your head, you know, staring at the keyboard and writing, to all of a sudden you're standing out on a tee with a golf club in your hand and three guys you may or may not know in the foursome, waiting to see how badly or how well you're going to hit it. The pressure going from a very personal and sort of insular existence now at a very public sort of social existence. And most writers are not social people at all. They're antisocial, and they should be. I mean, they're not fit to be out in the real world, most of them. So it was a big leap and a difficult one that I still haven't figured out how to make.
Well, it sounds like you're starting to get over the hump there. If you got enough pulley tests, etiquette, good nature left in you on there to have some partners when you golf?
There's a few people who will actually play
enough.
Golf with me, but they know not to say much. And frequently I'll wander off in the middle of a round because to look for my ball. They won't see me for a hole or two sometimes.
Well, maybe you're out there with your laptop, I don't know, somewhere.
No, I'm out there much worse.
Carl Hyson, it's always wonderful to speak with you, and it's great to have you today. The new book is The Downhill Lie, A Hacker's Return to a Ruinous Game. Good luck on the links, Carl. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom. Need it. Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I've checked the wind and took my practice swing. Now watch it fly toward that hole in the green. How sweet it felt when I made contact. Look at that sucker, it's a coming back. On this golf course anyway. I hate this game. I'll probably never play again. Anybody wanna buy